in other large industries. So the one employer that was really open to so many black workers in Philadelphia was the municipal government. And they took these blue-collar jobs and built lives that way. So the fact that the union represents these workers historically, you know, it shows the racial dynamics of how the economy has worked and continues to work across the country and certainly in Philadelphia.
And finally, what do you see coming next? I mean, we just got the rumblings of the end of the deal, the end of the strike this morning at 4. There hasn't even been a news conference yet. Francis Ryan.
Right. Right. I think that what the union leadership will be doing is they need to convince their members that the contract is the best one that they can get. And it's the union members themselves over the next few days that will vote upon this contract. And it's really in their hands. So I, like every other citizen in the city, we're waiting to see what the union members do. And I know that the hearts of a lot of Philadelphians are with these workers as they return back to work today.
Francis Ryan, labor historian, associate professor at Rutgers University, author of AFSCME's Philadelphia Story, Municipal Workers and Urban Power in the 20th Century. You can go to democracynow.org to see our full-time job offerings for multiple positions. democracynow.org/jobs. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from Metropolitan Family Services Cash Oregon, committed to improving the financial health of low to moderate income families and individuals by providing free tax preparation services. Volunteers are currently needed to support this program. All training is provided and no tax experience is necessary. More info on volunteering at cashoregon.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Oregon Department of Transportation gears up for the largest layoff in state history.
Oregon Governor Tina Kotek wants to ban student cell phone usage in all public schools in the state.
And in U.S./international news, Donald Trump walks back tariffs again, this time until August 1st.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 9th, 2025. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Josh Salem. KBOO is currently in our summer membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. Governor Tina Kotek has issued an order requiring nearly 200 public schools in Oregon implement a policy that restricts cell phone use during school hours. Each school must submit its policies by October 31st, detailing how it will prevent students from using phones from bell to bell. This ban means students won't have access to their phones during passing periods or lunch, making Oregon the 27th state to regulate cell phone use in schools. The goal is to limit constant exposure to social media, which can negatively impact young developing brains. Kotek's order comes amid a national movement to ban phones in schools due to concerns about mental health and academic distractions. The executive order does not specify how or where students should store their devices, leaving that decision to individual districts. They may provide locker pouches or require students to leave phones in their vehicles or at home. Additionally, districts must outline disciplinary actions for those who violate the ban, which will be enforced uniformly. In 2024, cell phone rules varied widely from school to school. While some students and parents have pushed back against the ban, many students agree that phones can distract from learning.
Many argue for cell phone access during passing periods and lunch to stay in contact with families and employers. Harvey Bloyd, a recent graduate from Kalmiopsis Community Arts High School, emphasized the importance of cell phones for communication and medical needs in his testimony to lawmakers. He said, quote, "Cell phones are used for a wide variety of things, including but not limited to social contact, inspiration, interactive entertainment, medical needs, and emergency contacts," end quote. Several schools in the Portland and North Clackamas areas have already updated their policies. Students at Milwaukee High School, who use locking pouches to keep their phones off limits, report improved focus and better peer interactions. Teacher Marianne Schnell-Bruton from the Tiger-Tualatin School District noted that allowing devices in the classroom can hinder efforts to engage students fully. Schnell-Bruton said in testimony to lawmakers, quote, "As instructors, we are already being as creative as possible to keep hold of our students' fleeting attention. Allowing devices into our learning space thwarts efforts to keep our students fully engaged. If the executive order is finalized, it will take effect on January 1st, 2026.
The Oregon Department of Transportation, along with the cities of Beaverton, the city of Portland, and scores of other cities and municipalities all across the state of Oregon, gear up for the crushing effects of the failure of House Bill 2025. Mayors Lacey Beattie of Beaverton and Keith Wilson of Portland testified in opposition to any changes to the state of Oregon transportation budget. Mayor Wilson believes the lack of state funding will jeopardize many essential city jobs, and that is in addition to the 483 jobs lost in the ranks of the Oregon Department of Transportation. On June 27th, the Oregon legislature ended its most recent session without passing a transportation package, providing ODOT with either new funding, funding flexibility, or even an interim investment to stabilize services for the immediate upcoming biennium. As a result, ODOT will have to make deep and painful cuts starting in the next few weeks. Even with supermajorities in both the Oregon House of Representatives and the Oregon Senate, Democratic lawmakers failed. The Republican minority celebrated their failure. Democratic Governor Tina Kotek says the failure of HB 2025 marks the largest mass layoff in the history of Oregon state government. Kotek says, quote, "These layoffs constitute an emergency in Oregon's transportation system that will hurt every part of Oregon. While we sharpen our pencils to temper the pace of layoffs from one wave into two, there will not be enough workers to provide the level of response Oregonians rely on, whether it's filling a pothole or clearing a safe passage for evacuation when a fire strikes," end quote. Republican House Minority Leader Christine Drazen said, quote, "Families are making cuts, and people every day are trying to figure out how to tighten their belt. I don't want anybody to lose their job, but I don't want to assume that everything that a state agency did yesterday, that we have to do it no matter what, in perpetuity," end quote. As ODOT sheds almost 500 state workers, it also plans to close 12 maintenance outposts around the state. ODOT leaders say as they work to close a $354 million funding gap, road repairs, road striping, litter pickup, snow plowing, and many other much-needed services will be lost. That second round of layoffs is expected to begin in early 2026. The future of ODOT itself remains uncertain.
A new survey reveals most Gen Z high school students and their parents are largely unaware of the full range of options available post-graduation, other than going to a four-year college or getting a job. Brett Prevetto has more on the story.
Most Gen Z high school students and their parents are unaware of the range of options available to kids after graduation, according to a new survey. The Gallup panel findings reveal more than half of families know a great deal about working at a paid job or earning a bachelor's degree, but feel far less informed about alternatives, like certification programs or apprenticeships. Jeff Bulanda with the nonprofit Jobs for the Future says too often family conversations about post-graduation plans occur too late.
Young people actually really trust and rely on their parents' guidance. 90% of young people said they rely on their parents' guidance when it comes to education and careers.
In the survey, just over half of all parents reported they frequently have those conversations with their high school-aged child, raising to 65% among parents with high school seniors. Bulanda says students engaged in those discussions are far more likely to show interest in career and education alternatives. Experts note that without early and well-informed discussions, students are often forced to make life-shaping decisions on their own. Working parents' schedules and a severe shortage of high school guidance counselors nationwide can add to students feeling unprepared. Bulanda says Jobs for the Future is working to build an online navigation tool to help students better connect their interests to potential career pathways and inform graduates entering the workforce about the right questions to ask.
Does this employer offer tuition assistance or some form of education benefit where they may start in a frontline job but have the ability to earn money as well as have their employer pay for their education?
Bulanda says today fewer than 3 in 10 high schoolers say they feel very prepared to pursue post-secondary options. Uncertainty about federal spending for higher education doesn't help. He says the key is to take a step back and consider all potential funding sources, including at the state and local level, where grants for short-term training programs often help move students into in-demand careers. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Oregon News Service, I'm Brett Pivato.
USDA and DHS secretaries collaborate on a National Farm Security Action Plan. Health advocates worry about the budget impact of the Big Beautiful Bill. And Prime Minister Netanyahu nominates Donald Trump for a Nobel Peace Prize. With those stories and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Securing and protecting American farmland ownership, actively engaging at every level of government to take swift legislative and executive action to ban the purchase of American farmland by Chinese nationals and other foreign adversaries.
Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins says she and Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem are collaborating on the National Farm Security Action Plan. The 7-point policy would increase disclosure of foreign farmland ownership and increase penalties for false filings. China owns less than 0.5% of U.S. farmland, according to the American Farm Bureau, and foreigners own around 3% of American farmland, about 40 million acres out of nearly 900 million. Healthcare groups say Medicaid cuts in the budget megabill will disproportionately impact LGBTQ plus people, almost 2 million of whom use the program. Medicaid pays for much of the country's home care, and Jamie Worker with the nonprofit Caring Across Generations says people already wait years to get it. She says non-heterosexual individuals face additional barriers accessing services like those.
Not everyone is aware about the services available. LGBTQ folks are also more likely to experience discrimination while trying to access care needs.
New research confirms the issues the budget presents for hospitals and clinics. An Urban Institute report projects changes to Medicaid and Medicare mean hospital revenues will fall by nearly $34 billion. And Tiffany Donaldson with the Connecticut Health Foundation says providers will lose revenue because people won't get the care they need.
We're scared more people are going to lose their coverage, that people, because of this, are going to be sicker, and that we are going to lose lives because of this.
Around 17 million people are expected to lose their health insurance by 2034 because of the bill, mostly due to new work requirements. Able-bodied Medicaid recipients ages 19 to 64 must work, volunteer, or go to school for 80 hours a month. Arkansas enacted Medicaid work requirements like those in 2018. Keisa Smith-Brantley with Arkansas Advocates for Children and Family says most of those kicked out of the state's program did qualify, but got tangled in the red tape.
We saw horrible examples of individuals who work in the food industry and in other industries where your hours fluctuate. One month they were eligible and the next month they weren't, and that was getting individuals removed from the Medicaid rolls.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is nominating President Donald Trump for the 2025 Nobel Peace Prize. He credits the president with brokering the Abraham Accords during his first term and with ceasefire and hostage releases in Gaza more recently. Netanyahu praises Trump for peace through strength, including the bombing of Iranian nuclear facilities.
The resolute decision of President Trump to act with us against those who seek to destroy Israel and threaten the peace of the world has made a remarkable change in the Middle East.
The Supreme Court is allowing Trump's plan to downsize federal agencies to move forward, at least for now. Associate Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson was the lone dissenting voice, saying this will dismantle the federal government as Congress created it. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after the newscast for an in-depth report with Donovan Scribes, curator and editor of the Portland Mercury's Blackout Edition. At 6, it's Flashpoints. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be a high of 77 and a low of 59. Tomorrow will be a high of 80 and a low of 59. Today in history, the iconic American singer-songwriter Bob Dylan recorded Blowin' in the Wind. This quote of the day is from the song Dylan wrote. How many years can a mountain exist before it's washed to the sea? Yes, and how many years can some people exist before they're allowed to be free? Yes, and how many times can a man turn his head, pretending he just doesn't see? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
The Eklutna tribe has operated its new casino outside Anchorage, Alaska, under the shadow of two separate lawsuits. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Eklutna tribe has operated its new casino outside Anchorage, Alaska, under the shadow of two separate lawsuits. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride reports, a federal judge has dismissed one.
Ever since a group of property owners tried to block the casino with a lawsuit, tribal advocates have kept a close eye on this case because their attorney, Don Mitchell, challenged the Native Village of Eklutna's status as a federally recognized tribe.
Congress has never allowed a middle-ranking employee of the Interior Department to just wave a magic wand and create 200 Indian tribes, either in Alaska or any other place.
Mitchell is referring to Ada Deer, who was Assistant Interior Secretary in the Bill Clinton administration. In 1993, she included Eklutna in a list of Alaska tribes on the Federal Register to eliminate any doubt that they have the same status as other tribes in the United States. Numerous court cases have tried and failed to invalidate Deer's decision. Last month, U.S. District Judge James Robart stood by those cases and ruled that the Eklutna lawsuit should be dismissed in equity and good conscience. Tribal legal experts like Michelle Demert applauded the ruling but says cases like this one consume time, energy, and precious dollars.
Time and time again, the law is clear in these areas that continue to be challenged. If the argument was that the Eklutna tribe is not a tribe, you know, there's legal precedent, there's federal law that says they are.
In a statement, Aaron Leggett, the president of the Native Village of Eklutna, called the ruling a significant step forward because it affirmed an important principle to the tribe that its rights are firmly rooted in the land. The tribe does face another lawsuit, this one brought on by the Alaska Attorney General. It also aims to shut down the casino. I'm Rhonda McBride.
A recent federal law that passed in the Canadian Parliament has drawn criticism and anger from Indigenous leaders. More from Dan Karpinchuk.
First, there was Bill 5 from Ontario, which allowed the provincial cabinet to designate special economic zones, the aim to fast-track resource development such as mining of critical minerals. That bill passed without consultation from First Nations, and they say it oversteps treaty obligations. Now at the federal level, the controversial Bill C-5 has also passed. It's legislation to fast-track major projects across Canada. It gives Ottawa the power to sidestep environmental protections and other laws. Originally, it was aimed at circumventing the Indian Act, but that part was removed. Some Native leaders have warned that it could lead to protests and legal challenges if it does not respect rights and title. And some had called on members of Parliament and other lawmakers to slow down Bill C-5 so that Indigenous leaders could review the law. Senator Paul Prosper, who is Mi'kmaq, is calling the rushed passage of the legislation a betrayal.
We do not want success and progress to come on the backs of Indigenous peoples. We want to be at the table, making decisions alongside Canadian politicians, because these decisions affect us. They affect our lands and resources.
Prosper said Canada is becoming a country of extremes, and the ability for moderate social discourse is gone. The Canadian Chamber of Commerce praised the quick passage of the bill, saying it has the potential to unleash the Canadian economy, but also urged the government to ensure that there is full compliance with rights of Indigenous communities and environmental standards. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Flying somewhere this summer? You can keep your shoes on at the airport. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem announced yesterday that travelers will no longer be required to remove their footwear at airport security lines. Noem said, "We are excited with the fact that we have the technology now, that we have the multiple layers of screening that we built in over the recent several years that give us the ability to allow our travelers to keep their shoes on." The announcement came just yesterday, but some airports around the country had already stopped asking customers to remove their shoes. The government began requiring airline passengers to take off their footwear during security checks in 2006, around 5 years after British-born Richard Reid tried to detonate a bomb hidden in his shoes on a flight from Paris to Miami.
There have now been more measles cases in 2025 than in any other year since 2000, when ironically the virus was declared eliminated in the United States. It's only July, but already 1,288 people have had a confirmed case of measles, 92% of whom were unvaccinated or whose vaccination status was unknown. For every 1,000 children who get measles, one or two will die. Two unvaccinated children and one adult have died from measles this year. Roughly 93%, below the 95% required to stem the virus's spread of children in kindergarten in the 2023 through 2024 school year, had received the measles, mumps, and rubella, or MMR shot, though rates in some parts of the country were far lower. Most of the cases this year have been tied to the Southwest outbreak, the largest single outbreak since 2000, which began in January in a Mennonite community in West Texas. But cases have then popped up in 38 states, including Oregon, Washington, and California. The measles virus causes immune amnesia, making the body unable to defend itself against other illnesses it has already been exposed to, and leaving people more susceptible to future infections. Canada has already had a record number of cases this year, and earlier this spring, the World Health Organization announced that Europe had reported the highest number of measles cases in more than 25 years. In the U.S., 2019 had held the record for the highest number of cases since 2000.
Early Tuesday morning, Mount Rainier experienced hundreds of small, nearly imperceptible earthquakes, reminding Western Washington residents they live near the largest stratovolcano in the Cascade Mountain Range. The swarm of earthquakes continued into Wednesday, with the largest quake so far measured at 2.3 at 9 a.m. this morning, as reported by the Pacific Northwest Seismic Network. This is the largest swarm of earthquakes since a similar three-day event in 2009, some 15 years ago. The U.S. Geological Survey posted on its USGS Volcanoes social media site that, quote, "Earthquake swarms are relatively common at Mount Rainier, typically occurring 1 to 2 times per year, but usually with many fewer events than have been detected so far during the current swarm," end quote. The USGS says the current seismic activity is attributed to, quote, "circulation of hydrothermal fluids as they interact with pre-existing faults at shallow levels below the summit of the volcano," end quote. "There is no cause for concern," say officials at the Cascade Volcano Observatory, or CVO, who monitors volcanoes across the Pacific Northwest. "These," quote, "earthquakes are too small to be felt at the surface and will likely continue for several days. There would be no damage caused by such small events," end quote. In spite of the increased seismic activity, USGS and CVO officials say the volcano's alert levels remain at normal and the aviation color code is green. The USGS went on to say Mount Rainier has not significantly erupted over the last 500 years.
Donald Trump and his advisors promised some 90 global trade negotiations with dozens of countries back in April. Just 2.22% of them have actually materialized. The administration officials predicted other countries would be desperate to make concessions to avoid the massive tariffs that Trump was threatening to impose on their products starting July 9th. But the United Kingdom and Vietnam are the only countries that have formally come to the table. Trump has announced a framework for a China deal, but no details have been forthcoming. Trump just extended the deadline for negotiations to August 1st, leaving the global trading system pretty much where it stood 3 months ago, in limbo. All the back and forth has resulted in Trump earning the acronym label TACO, which stands for Trump Always Chickens Out. William Ryanch, an advisor with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said, quote, "This is classic Trump. Threaten, threaten more, but then extend the deadline. July 30th arrives. Does he do it again if he still doesn't have the deals?" End quote. Trump did say yesterday that there will be no more extensions. It all truly began on April 2nd, or on Liberation Day, as Trump called it. At that time, he announced a baseline 10% import tax on everybody, and what he labeled reciprocal levies of up to 50% on countries with which the United States runs trade deficits. Tariffs averaged around 2.5% when Trump returned to the White House, and they were even lower before his first term. Trump has deviated from a set of rules that governed world trade for decades. The United States and most other countries abided by tariff rates set through a series of complex negotiations known as the Uruguay Round.
Trump's Liberation Day tariffs resulted in a four-day plunge in global financial markets. Trump added, suspended the reciprocal tariffs less than 13 hours after they went into effect. Earlier in the week, and frustrated by the lack of progress, Trump sent letters to Japan, South Korea, and 12 other countries saying he would impose tariffs August 1st if they couldn't reach an agreement. The levies were close to what he'd announced back in April. Trump did sign an agreement last month with the United Kingdom that reduced U.S. tariffs on British automotive and aerospace products while opening the U.K. market for American beef and ethanol. On July 2nd, Trump announced a deal with Vietnam in which the Vietnamese government agreed to let U.S. products into the country duty-free while accepting a 20% tax on their exports to the United States. While the lopsided deal with Vietnam suggests that Trump may be able to successfully use the tariff threat to bully concessions out of smaller economies, experts think making deals with bigger trading partners will remain much tougher. Reince called it, quote, a giant game of chicken. Dan says, don't let Trump make your summer a bummer. Now we'll go to Poe Justice with Portland poet Don Raphael.
Whether it's 95 degrees or 70, summer's not going to stop. Ripe berries now, other fruit and veggies to come. Don't just sweat there, do something, preferably with other beings. Bad things will happen. At least 120 flood deaths in Texas. A fire in California covered 82 square miles. That's from Killingsworth to Powell, the Willamette to 181st, all aflame. Hurricane season's also started. More flooding rains, more heat domes, regional power failures. Donnie's big ugly bill is more like drought than rain. No flash floods, more a slow erosion. A sinkhole where the clinic was. One bag of groceries for the price of two. Fruit rotting on trees cause the men in black hoods could come to the orchards. The only checks in the mail are going to those who don't need them. Still there's sunshine, rivers, lakes, ocean, forests to bathe in, mountains for hiking and camping, friends to do those things with, share fresh and roasted food with. The living might not be easy, but it sure can be good. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Josh Salem, James Kemp, Dave Johnson, Dan Raphael, and Hannah Francis. The producer is me, Dave Johnson, and our engineer is Hannah Francis. Special thanks to Edwin J. Vieira, Antonia Gonzalez, and Brett Prevetto. The interim evening news director is Hannah Francis. A podcast of the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Dave Johnson.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's News in Depth with Donovan Scribes.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Hannah Francis. Today, I'm joined by Donovan Scribes, award-winning writer, producer, and communications consultant based in Portland, Oregon. He's the curator and editor of the recent Portland Mercury's The Recent Portland Mercury Special Blackout Edition, a five-year retrospective on the murder of George Floyd and Portland's racial justice protests of 2020. He's also the creator of an accompanying exhibit currently at the Black Gallery in downtown Portland. Hi, Donovan. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So first, how did you start this project and what was the process of getting these folks together like?
Yeah, it really just being here in Portland and obviously seeing the protests unfold and the messaging coming from those 100 plus days start to get unwound before the first year was away from us. And definitely as we're getting into year.